The bridges of New York have inspired everyone from Jack Kerouac to Woody Allen, who put the Queensboro Bridge in the opening shot of his movie Manhattan. That bridge is also famous in hip-hop.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got MC Shan and Molly Mall in the house tonight. They just came from off tour, and they want to tell you a little story about where they come from.
In 1985, MC Shan made this record called The Bridge. In it, he implied that hip-hop was born in Queensbridge, a housing project in the shadow of the Queensboro Bridge.
You love to hear the story again and again of how it all got started way back when. The monument is right in your face. Sit and listen for a while to the name of the place.
A rapper from the Bronx named KRS-One had a beef with that song and responded with this track.
That's it. The bridge is over, the bridge is over. Bye-bye. The bridge is over, the bridge is over.
The Bridge is Over sparked hip-hop's first big feud and made KRS-One famous. And KRS-One made a huge impression on an aspiring rapper from Brooklyn named Talib Kweli. Kweli told Kurt about a rainy night when he snuck into a KRS-One concert.
Yeah, you're ready.
And I went to the club to see KRS-One film some portions of a live album he was recording in 1991. And I have pictures from that night. And I was hanging out with Nikki D and Tommy Davidson and Red Alert. And at 15 years old, these are people who were just celluloid to me. I could never imagine that I would be standing next to them in person. I must have looked like a real jerk just with a camera. Camera and a raincoat, like 15-year-old.
Nerd.
Take a picture. Yeah, exactly. But I saw KRS-One perform, and I'll never forget how the turntable kept skipping. The record kept skipping, and there was no stage, and he was sort of hanging off a balcony.
Not deliberately skipping.
No, not deliberately. He was hanging off a balcony, but he rocked it, and I wasn't prepared for that. I'm like, the conditions are not conducive to you rocking it, and you in here making this whole building move.
And from then on, you were on this route, basically?
Yeah, I think I wanted to do the performance thing after that.
So as a teenager, really, or certainly as a young man, you burst on the scene in the late 90s as half of Black Star, your sort of underground duo with Mos Def. How did you and Mos Def hook up?
I met Mos Def hanging out in Washington Square Park.
In the Village?
Uh-huh. You know, the kids in my neighborhood in Flatbush, they were just standing on the corner. And there was always a group of us, two or three of us, who would be like, okay, well, we're going to actually get on the train and go to the city. And, you know, Washington Square Park around that time was pre-Giuliani time, and it was sort of like an arts festival, especially in the summertime. You had magicians, you had people performing Shakespeare, juggling, you know, and us freestyling fit right into the novelty of it all. And it's like we would freestyle and get crowds of people around us, and Mos Def, who was acting already, you know, he used to come through the park and hang out.
And then you got together and said, hey, let's make a record together?
Yeah, years later, when he had put out a couple records, he was touring with De La Soul, and I was working at the bookstore. I was just a fan of his. I gave him my demo tape just as a fan, like, here, my name is Kweli, check this out. You know, our paths were just aligned, you know. We were two MCs from Brooklyn who had kids the same age who were rapping, kicking rap songs and poetry readings.
Let's before we talk some more, let's listen to a track from that album with Mos Def.
It's a paradox we call reality. So keeping it real will make you a casualty of abnormal normality. Killers born naturally like Mickey and Mallory. Not knowing the ways will get you capped like an NBA salary. So cast BMC and to illustrate what we be seeing. Hard to be a spiritual being, wishing to shake what you believe in. The trees to grow in Brooklyn, seeds need to be planted. I'm asking if y'all feel me, and the crowd left me stranded. My blood pressure boiled and rose. These New York niggas act to spoil their shows. To the winners, the spoils go. I take the L, transfer to the 2, head to the gates. New York life type trife, the Roman Empire State.
So much on my mind, I just can't recline. Bless the holes in the night till she bless sunshine. Breathe in and hail vapors from bright stars that shine. Breathe out.
Now, that song that you did with Mos Def gives a great sense of how you pack in the allusions and cultural references. I mean, the Oliver Stone movie, the Tree Grows in Brooklyn, all this New York subway references, this great phrase, the Roman Empire State. What's that about?
That song is just dealing with the idea of the city breathing and like a living organism. New York, Common is on that record as well. He's from Chicago, which is a similar type of city. And sometimes at night, you know, when you're in the city, there's so much life, you can feel it sort of pulsating.
Hip-hop in general, at its best, does a lot to express that visceral urban sense, doesn't it?
That's what's great about good art, is it takes its lead from what's actually happening.
Uh-huh. Let's break down a track from your new album. It's called Country Cousins.
Yo, son, this block is death. Word is country cousins. See it pop off real quick. Yes, I gotta get that copper and I mean. Growing up in Brooklyn, yeah, I thought that everybody talked this way. Raised on Rock Him and Run DMC, so I thought that everybody walked this way. We fresh, we chill, we deaf, we ill. It's just some things I was taught to say. And every Saturday morning, I watch cartoons with a bowl of frosted flakes. And the puberty came, started hitting them cuties with game, and the truancy came. Started cutting and just class, I was coming on fast, I was new to the game. Music playing on TV, courtesy of Video Music Box Plus. Knew a lot of hustlers going OT, coming back with a new hip-hop light. E40 holding
again, that's Country Cousins from your new album. It, absolutely stuffed with, like, five allusions per 2 seconds. I hear your music, and it seems wittier and kind of has a lighter touch than a lot of hip-hop. Do you agree?
You know, I think my music, the aggressiveness of my music is not in posing or posturing. It's in the thoughts and the ideas. So it's not a lot of over aggression, I guess.
You're not playing a big character version of yourself.
Yeah, there's no need. I think this subject matter is strong enough.
Yeah. And how do you come up with lyrics? I mean, are you rhyming in your head? Are you thinking of lyrics?
Images pop in your head and things to rhyme about come in your head. But more recently, it's been the tracks. Like a track like that, you know, it started to make me think about growing up. And then I started talking about, you know, a big thing in hip-hop right now is how regional it is and how, you know, down south artists are way more successful right now. And I think there are things about New York hip-hop that we're not being honest about. You know, we never paid attention to any of this.
Because this was the place it began.
Exactly.
Why paying attention to those outposts?
Exactly. So we've been very arrogant about it. And in the meantime, what we forced them to do is support each other and build up their own networks. And they started selling CDs out of their trunks. And fast forward 10 years later, now they're way more successful. And the music is a different type of culture. It's a celebration, strip club culture, a lot of times with songs from down south. And it's like, that's what it's really about. Whereas in New York, we've been so focused on the art of it that we've been missing the paycheck.
As you're making these songs, how do you choose what you're going to sample?
What happens is, I really, to be honest with you, when I pick beats, I'm not looking for samples.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking for things that are original. But I'm such a fan of old music that when I hear a beat that has a sample in it, it's just, I don't know, like I'm just drawn to it. And it becomes a problem. It becomes such a problem that I have to push my album release date back because the label's like, we have to clear all these samples. Whereas a lot of hip hop is keyboard and synthesizer stuff and, you know, stuff that you don't really have to clear.
Let's listen to a bit of an old soul tune that you sampled.
Fred Williams.
Listen, listen, something I wanna tell you.
As you say, that is Fred Williams, a song called Tell Her by Fred Williams and the Jewels Band.
You wanna hear something funny? Huh. I just added that to my set today. I came from rehearsal. I said, you know what, before we perform Listen, we're gonna play this Tell Her.
Synchronicity.
Yeah.
Let's hear how you looped the beat on your first single. Listen.
This the year the blacksmith. Talib Kweli. Kweli. K1. Let's go. Listen. Yeah. Yeah. Duh. Listen. Back in the days we all used to. Listen. Now they're so whack. Nobody. Listen. To that real hip hop. Yo. Listen. Ladies and gentlemen. Get ready. Here comes Talib Kweli. And I'm banging on your ears. Something I wanna tell you. Now let me get up in it.
There's the Romans thing again.
This Roman civilization we're living in right now.
There you go. So tell me how your creative process works in that case, how this Fred Williams tune gets folded into your song, Listen.
Well, there's a producer named Kwame who's a rap artist. He had a few records out back in the days, and he produced it, and then he called me up, and he said, I want you to rap on this. You know, he did a very good job. There are producers who just loop songs, and then there are producers who chop beats and take certain elements of the track and recreate. I mean, if you, you know, just playing that sample and hearing what he did with it, he did a lot of interesting, good stuff. And
tell me the difference, though, between those two modes.
Well, you know, there's just a straight loop where it's like you'll hear a record and you'll be like, oh, that's such and such. It's Cool in the Gang, or that's James Brown or whatever. With that record, he took the guitar lick, doop, doop, that comes in after, wait just a minute, and doop, doop, and he made that the basis of my song. So that one guitar lick is the basis of my actual track. It took me even a minute, even though I listened to that song today, when you played it just now, it took me a minute to realize, because it's the intro and I don't even know which parts he took, but it wasn't just a straight loop where it's like you recognize it.
It's more integrated.
Yes.
You have rapped about and talked about how there ought to be more rap songs with less misogyny, less celebrations of violence, less foul language, shallow verses than there are in lots of commercial hip hop. Is that a main way that you see your music is different?
Yeah. When I do that, when I'm critical of the art form, I do it within the art form.
Mm-hmm.
And I make the songs that can be the examples for how we can do it. I try not to be too critical of artists expressing themselves, but I try to express myself and to show the balance, so there's a different way we can do it.
And it's not all one thing or the other for you. You, for instance, you've said you're going to try to reduce the use of the N-word in your songs, but not take the abstinence pledge.
Right. It's not the artist's job to be politically correct or morally upstanding. It's The artist's job to be honest with how they express themselves. And sometimes an artist being less moral makes them a better artist. And that's the messed up thing about art, is that sometimes you can have real jerks create great art, and you just got to deal with it.
Although, what about the simple idea that lots of people, black and white, put out that, yes, these artists are reflecting a coarse, ugly set of circumstances and culture, but it reinforces them, it glorifies them.
I think the selling of those images glorifies things. And you know, I think record companies and corporations have to be responsible for what they're selling, because it's not the artist's job to be responsible for that. Now,
right.
when you're now selling, putting a barcode on it and a price, and you're selling it, or when you're a program director and you decide to play a song that belongs in a strip club at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, is that the fault of the artist for making
the song?
I
don't want to be in a strip club at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, you don't want to hear that song. You don't want to be thinking about skeet 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 when you're picking up your kids from school. You know, and there's a room for everything. There needs to be a song that you can hear when it's time to pick up your kids from school, and then there needs to be songs when you're in a strip club at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, we need all of it.
Oh, 3 o'clock in the morning. Sure. Thinking about the use of the N-word, a phrase I hate to say.
Mm-hmm. I hate the phrase, too.
In 10 years, in 20 years, in 30 years, do you think its use or its connotations or its frequency will change? Or did it just start 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and this is how it's going to be? What do you foresee?
I think as we gain more information, the problem seems bigger than what it is. I don't think black people use the word any more or less now in 2007 than we used it in 1937.
Really?
Yeah, I just think that now, through the internet and through the hip-hop being so big culturally,
the rock has been turned over.
Right. So now it's like, oh my God, this is a problem. What is all this uproar over the language? There's 100 things to have uproar over, you know. And it's like okay, so if we stop saying it, are our communities going to be just going to be better fruit in the neighborhood grocery store? I don't understand.
So you grew up partly in Park Slope, a very nice neighborhood in Brooklyn. You went to boarding school. Your parents are college professors. You rap about Saturday morning cartoons and Norman Mailer and venture capitalists. And you're a big Second Life user online, I guess.
I'm not that big a Second Life user, but I've been on there a couple times.
How does all that stuff go down in the hip-hop world? How does that affect your reputation in that world?
I think I'm closer to the average hip-hop fan with all the things that you just named than, you know, your average thugged-out 16-bar rapper.
Good point.
I think that's somebody who's on the fringe. You know, I did a show last night with Kanye West and Common and Mos Def. And Rod Digger jumped on stage, and Queen Latifah jumped on stage. And I met Jacques Chirac's son, who apparently is a big hip-hop fan and makes beats. And, you know, and then I went to another party after.
I would like to have videotaped that encounter between Jacques Chirac's son and you.
And he's great. And he knew the songs. And I went to another club, even crazier. And then he was there at the other club. And I'm introducing him to people, and they're like, oh, yeah, I already know him. You know, so it's like, that's the average hip-hop fan, someone who can deal with people from all walks of life, you know.
Talib Kweli, thanks very much for coming into Studio 360.
Thank you.
You left me.
Yes. Welcome to the wonderful sounds of Talib Kweli. Ladies, I got you in the mood. For interlude, roar like in the nude. I hope this ain't considered rude, but let's stop talking because it's feeling like an interview. I know you're into me, so let me get
Talib Kweli's new album is called Eardrum. It'll be released next week, but you can hear a track right now at studio360.org. I'm Julie Burstein, in for Kurt Anderson today. Coming up, we visit Machu Picchu and hear about the controversy over where its artifacts belong. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Wow. That's a nice track.